Hannes Meyer's Bauhaus was Bauhaus. Because the vice in the Soviet Union, the goal is completely contrary. The idea is not to have a kind of a universally thinking professional which is capable of doing actually everything in architecture. No, the idea is that to have someone who can go tomorrow work in the huge design institute to do some standard operations. So it's not about architecture with a big A. My name is Tatiana Efusi. I'm an artist and architecture historian. I started working on topics related to Bauhaus connections with the Soviet Union. And there, of course, Hannes Meyer was a central figure.
My name is Anja Guttenberger, and this is my podcast, Bauhaus Faces. Welcome to part 2 of the Bauhaus Faces episode on Hannes Meyer. This time, we will talk about Meyer's work and life in the Soviet Union between 1930 and 1936. To fully understand what we are discussing today, please listen to the first part with Dara Kiese and Thomas Flierl about Hannes Meyer's way to the Bauhaus and the pedagogical and structural changes he brought into this famous school. We left that first part with Hannes Meyer's dismissal from the Bauhaus in August 1930 because of uprising communist activities at the school and Meyer's insufficient containment of it. A caricature of Hannes Meyer by Adolf Hofmeister, published in a Czech magazine in 1931, shows the former Bauhaus director with hammer and sickle, symbols of communism, in his left hand and with his right hand in his trouser pocket, which mockingly describes the whole situation. And although in Meyer's estate at the Damm, the Deutsche Architekturmuseum in Frankfurt am Main, you can even find a maquette of a complete Bauhaus album that Meyer wanted to publish, but never found a publishing house for. But his heart always beat for the socialist cause. In an interview published in Pravda on 10th of October 1930, on his decision to leave Germany to go to the Soviet Union, Hannes Meyer said, "After many years of working within the capitalist system, I am convinced that working under such conditions is quite senseless. I am leaving for the USSR to work among people who are forging a true revolutionary culture, who are achieving socialism, and who are living in that form of society for which we have been fighting here under the conditions of capitalism." Meyer left in 1930 for the Soviet Union and would stay until 1936. In those 6 years, he worked on several different projects, so many that Tatiana Efusi made a whole book based on her PhD dissertation about only this short time span. It is called Hannes Meyer, Soviet Architect, Life and Work in the USSR 1930-1936 and was just recently published. You can, of course, find a link in the show notes. This time again, I will bring in Thomas Flierl for a few parts. We will today conclude with Hannes Meyer's departure from the Soviet Union and his attempt to go and work for the socialist revolution in Spain. As you can already see, we are not yet finished with Hannes Meyer with the second part. In the last part, you will next hear the Mexican art historian Raquel Franklin about Hannes Meyer's work in Mexico and his last years in Switzerland. I feel that we don't do him justice if I squeezed all of these amazing research results into just one episode. So bear with me and come back for the last part of this episode on Hannes Meyer. But for now, let's dive into a new episode of Bauhaus Faces and shine a light on Hannes Meyer's life and work in the Soviet Union.
Of course, she met artists and architects from the Soviet Union. For example, Alice Sitsky, she met him in 24, I guess, if I'm not mistaken, in Switzerland, because Alice Sitsky was there to do a treatment. And of course, Alice Sitsky was very important, was not someone critical, anyhow, of the Soviet project, also because it was very young and the project itself, the Soviet society. And it was really very interesting what was happening in the country. And Alice Sitsky was like a pioneer and should have been a very powerful figure, and she inspired the publication of the first magazine on avant-garde architecture in Switzerland, ABC, where also Hans Schmidt took part, who also came to the Soviet Union in the 30s. That was an important contact. And of course, it was somehow very fashionable. It was in the air. Everyone was in the avant-garde circles in Europe, was enchanted with things that was happening in the Soviet Union in general. course, constructivism, objects, pictures that arrive, films that arrive. Of course, it was very promising, was something new. There was a person sensible to everything vital. I'm sure that Hannes Meyer was impressed. Hannes Meyer was engaged with his avant-garde circles in the 20s in Switzerland. And there was also this influence of constructivist imagery on his creations with Hans Witwer. And they did the several projects that became very famous, like Petersschule, and then, of course, the projects for the League of Nations that won the second prize. And it became, like, all of a sudden, a Swiss architect, like a country which is not considered like the most industrially advanced at the time. All of a sudden, he produces a project which is so daring that wins the second prize. So they became internationally renowned. And Walter Gropius invited him to Bauhaus to teach architecture. And then it's 1927. And in 1927, 1928, there were groups of Soviet students of architecture who visited the Bauhaus. I'm sure there are a lot of other episodes which are not known, but there are some documents, articles, the stories of the students. There is one testimony by Ariel Sharon.
Maybe you have already listened to the episode of Bauhaus Faces about Ariel Sharon too. He was also interested in the Soviet life and was part of a student delegation of the Bauhaus that went to Moscow, a trip on which also Bauhaus master Gunther Stölzel went, and they then fell in love with each other. About Gunther Stölzel, there's also an episode online, so if you would like to look into their interest in the Soviet Union too, you should also listen to those episodes. And now back to Tatiana.
Ariel Sharon says that in summer 27, there were a group of Soviet students who came to Bauhaus in Dessau, and it was in summer, and no one else among the professors were on campus. So Hannes Meyer was there, and he did a tour. And it's very interesting because what we know is that there were some debates between Hannes Meyer and them, but we don't know what are those debates. But what's interesting, it's not like what I discovered when I was doing the more profound research, is that it's not just students of architecture. They were selected, so it's not only good students with good notes and potentially daring architects, but these are also communist youth activists and party members. These were the first years of the so-called five-year plan and the left turn in the politics, so the beginning of Stalinism, and the presence of these youth were engaged, not just citizens and students, but people who were really engaged in cultural revolution, like those who were sure that there is bourgeois art and there is proletarian art. And these people started really to gain importance also in architectural sphere, and architectural students was just the beginning of it, but it's already important because this delegation was consisting of those guys mostly. We know maybe seven names of these young architects, and five of them a year later would found an organization which is called All Russian and All Union Society of Proletarian Architects. And Hannes Meyer joined them when he just arrived in 1930, so several years later. So it's very interesting what this debate was about and who convinced whom in the end. But there is this encounter which was important. And then when Hannes Meyer was fired in August 1930, he reached out to the Soviet embassy and the Soviet agency for technical collaboration in Berlin and started to ask if there were any possibility of work in the Soviet Union, because Soviet Union started during this first five-year plan a massive program of construction and reconstruction of industry and later like cities for the industry. And it was a huge wave of foreign specialists, experts, industrial experts, engineers, but also architects who were invited to work and to help with this construction. So this was present. This was in the air. This existed as some opportunity that everyone knew about. And for example, earlier in 1930, Ernst May is an urban planner from Frankfurt am Main, who was very active in Frankfurt and was responsible for prefabricated construction in Frankfurt am Main. He first went on lectures, a series of lectures to the Soviet Union, and he was invited. He could select a group of his collaborators, and this team departed to the Soviet Union with a huge media coverage. Everyone knew that they were very well paid, and of course, also like for the first time, Ernst May and this group, which also counted Hans Schmidt or Margarete Schutte-Lihotzky, they could go and do things on a really big scale. It's not just like several Siedlungen, I don't know, settlements for workers around Frankfurt, but really construct new cities. So this was very inspiring. And Hannes Meyer thought he could do something like that, especially because he had all his graduates, his former students, people who were also expelled from Bauhaus because they were communists, but they were skilled. They had experience in his eyes, for example, his building department. They managed to design and construct several houses in Dessau, Laubengang-Häuser, the gallery-type houses. They also, the entire Bauhaus, participated in real-life construction in ADGB, trade union school. So Hannes Meyer thought that if Ernst May could do that, why couldn't I? I also have my group. I'm professional. That's what I could try to do. He got some contacts in this agency for technical collaboration. And also, there were several contacts. L. Lisitsky, I mentioned. So he also wrote to Lisitsky. He also wrote to a person, Lisitsky. In the end, he could not be very useful. He's arrived from Europe. Himself, his position was not that stable. But there were other people, for example, Genrich Ludwig, who is not known at all in Europe. No one ever heard about him. But actually, he also visited Bauhaus, among others. And this was an architect with an engineering background, something interesting for Hannes Meyer also, with his fantasy about technique engineering, real knowledge of how things are done. And Genrich Ludwig was also an administrator who occupied important positions in the hierarchy of Soviet architecture at the time. So in the end, it was Ludwig who helped Meyer obtain his first job, who permitted him to leave. And this was an institution called Gipraftus, meaning state agency for construction of schools and technical colleges. And Hannes Meyer was invited to work there. And his idea was long negotiations because Meyer wanted to also to arrive in this kind of a glory Marxist Bauhaus arrival. And it's not exactly how it worked. And in the end, he came himself in October 1930 with just one student at first, his former student, Bela Scheffler, who was a communist and he was expelled from the Bauhaus. Bela Scheffler spoke Russian because he was from what today is Belarus. So he accompanied Meyer also because he was a good guide in the society. And then they were joined later by some other students, but it was never the scale of Ernst May. And that made Hannes Meyer really bitter throughout all his time in the Soviet Union. It's clear that there is a lot of jealousy in their relations and also some ideological arguments which Hannes Meyer then starts to use to justify their incompatibility with Ernst May.
Die Bundesschule hat mit dazu beigetragen, dass er als erstes an einem...
The trade union school obviously contributed to the fact that he was first assigned chief architect at a central state institute for the planning of schools and higher education facilities, where he initially worked with some of the people who came later. He traveled ahead with some of them, others followed. They then lived at the Arbeit, but not all of them. This was then often referred to as the Meyer Brigade. They called themselves the Red Front Brigade, which both was analogous to the Ernst May Brigade. My aim is to make clear through research that Ernst May's status was incomparably higher and more important to the state and endowed with other competences than the self-chosen political immigration of Hannes Meyer and his students, and that he then also went his own way relatively soon and no longer pursued the care of his students as strongly. Even when the Red Front Brigade, under the guidance of Hannes Meyer, took part in the competition for the Soviet palace, he later repeatedly emphasized that he had only given advice and was not responsible for it, because the design was then very strongly and quickly criticized. So he also had difficulties there. He probably didn't initially realize the complicated political and institutional competition he was up against in the Soviet Union, and I don't think he was very well prepared for the situation. Ernst May was different. He had his advocates in a central position and also had all the powers and backgrounds, and that lasted for a certain amount of time.
Und hatten auch alle Vollmachten und Hintergründe, und das hielt dann auch eine gewisse Zeit.
Before diving into the work of Hannes Meyer in the Soviet Union, I asked Tatiana to paint a picture of Moscow in the early 1930s when Hannes Meyer and some of the Bauhaus students arrived there. They all, like Thomas already mentioned, stayed together in an apartment at Arbeit Square in Moscow. But what was living like in Moscow in the early 1930s?
So one of the key problems of the daily life in Moscow or any other big city in the 1930s is the shortage of housing and the impossibility, almost impossibility, to have to live in an individual apartment as a family. Because in the beginning of the 1930s, there is this process of industrialization, the construction of new factories, but actually it went in hand with the so-called collectivization of the agriculture. The idea was that all private farming should not exist. Agriculture is also an industry, so agricultural workers, they should be like industrial workers, organized in collective farms and like factories, but it's agriculture. So the peasants were forced into this kolkhoz, the collective farms, and there was extreme violence during this process. We cannot even imagine how violent it was, because there were hundreds of thousands of peasants who were considered rich or bourgeois or kulak, it was called, who were deported with their families. And there was a hunger. Of course, you heard about Holodomor in Ukraine. This was the part of the process, because Ukrainian peasants were considered as particularly keen to have this private property, because they were just more affluent, and they were punished for that. And they were also punished for being Ukrainians with their traditions. So all this was destroyed. And there are millions of people who died during this hunger. It's 1933. So 1930, it's not that far yet, but still former peasants, they all flee from the country. There is nothing to eat. And there are the soldiers and like communist delegations who are patrolling the countryside. The easiest way to survive was to flee in the city or in a new construction site. You don't have any documents anymore. You're just lost in this big city. So there are people everywhere. And the housing shortage is just enormous. And Hannes Meyer and some other Bauhaus students who arrived later, they ended up living in a communal apartment on Arbat Square in the center of Moscow with other families. So in the same apartment, I haven't really studied in detail the life of other Bauhäusler. I really advise you to read articles by Astrid Volpert, who knows much better than me.
Challenge accepted, Tatiana. I did read articles by Astrid Volpert and remembered that I even interviewed her about that exact same topic for the Bauhaus Imaginista project in 2019. This interview is called Praised, Sentenced, Forgotten, Rediscovered, 62 members of the Bauhaus in the land of the Soviets, and it is still online. I will, of course, link it for you in the show notes. But for now, I would like to at least attach names to the 7 Bauhaus students who followed Hannes Meyer to Moscow and called themselves the Red Front Brigade. Bela Scheffler, whom Tatiana already mentioned, Philipp Tolzina, René Mensch, Antonin Urban, Tibor Weiner, Konrad Püschel, and Klaus Neumann. They all had their very own experiences in the Soviet Union, and not all of them came back alive.
What I know from Meyer's eyes and Meyer's story is that he lives there. There are Soviet neighbors also in the same apartment. Of course, for them, at first, it's interesting, it's exotic, wow. And also, everything is different, and Meyer is completely seduced. Just to give one example, he comes across an architect who is actually a seaman from Odessa, Kalai Becker. And this former seaman who fought in the revolution, he decided to be an architect. And that's how Hannes Meyer has profound discussions of Athenian Acropolis with him. So this kind of incredible social promotion was possible, and it really existed, and it impressed Meyer very much. So they are living in this apartment. Then other Bauhäusler come also to share. They have rooms in this big apartment. It used to be a private apartment of a wealthy family before the revolution. And then the family was chased. They were expelled from this, or they left, or they were arrested. We don't know what happened. And the apartment was occupied by new inhabitants, and every possible space was used. a big sitting room, like salon, could be separated in four or as much space as possible from these conditions. And you can read some books by Ilf Petrov, who ironically described this situation in detail. It's very funny. And just to give you an example, my own family also lived in such an apartment. And my mother in the 50s, she lived in the center of Moscow. And she has a very tender childhood memories how someone lived in the bathroom. So there was no bathroom. And they went to the sauna every weekend to wash themselves. So that's how they lived. And when later in 1931, Lena Diagna also arrived to Moscow, she was a graduate of a textile department in Bauhaus, and they had an affair, and later they married. And all these living conditions, I mean, at first it's exotic, but then it's very tiring not to have any private space at all. So Maya, starting from 32, 33, she tries to obtain some private apartment, and she never succeeded. It must have been really frustrating because there was some other foreigners did have this, like not speaking about Anne Smythe, I think they were living in a hotel, but maybe I'm wrong. They were like hotels where foreign specialists could live for a long time. But there was also people like Kurt Meyer, a city planner from Cologne, who also was in Moscow at the same time. And he did obtain a new apartment and new buildings called houses for specialists. So Hannah Meyer's dream was to get one of those, and it never worked. This is really a crazy time. My book is dedicated only to the 6 years. It's so dense. There are so many things happening. So technically, she was invited to work as a head designer in this institution for design of schoolhouses, technical colleges. But she does plenty other things at the same time. For example, for many, many projects, there were public competitions and she sits on the juries. For example, House of Book, things we even don't know about today, was important, and Hannes Meyer was there. Then he was also invited as a consultant in the city planning institute called Ipralgor. And it was a very important experience for him because before he did work in the city planning, he studied garden cities in England in 1912. He was working for settlements at Margaret and Höhe in Germany. But this was never a question of designing new cities or looking at the scale of how to reconstruct the city, given the fact that under the planned economy, there should be now a textile industry and this kind of industry, and now it all has to be reorganized. And for example, they are sitting there in Moscow and they have to decide about cities which are being reconstructed or designed in Uzbekistan. I mean, it's something, it has nothing to do with Dessau or Basel. And then also he tries from the very beginning to impose himself also as a public figure and to get back to teaching. It's very important because he left the Bauhaus when he was a Bauhaus director, but also teaching was very important for him, has ideas on teaching. So he was eager to now find that there's no restrictions and I can actually finally realize my Marxist Bauhaus, which never actually existed at the Bauhaus, but now is the time. I told you he met this group of young students who visited the Bauhaus. So now these people, they were very active in the party circles and they gained enormous influence. When Hannes Meyer met them in Dessau, they were students of Hutemas Futein, an engineering school, MVTU, and some other institutions. Hutemas was an avant-garde analog of the Bauhaus, which, of course, of completely different context, much bigger scale and so on, but the ideas were kind of similar in the beginning. And in 1930, it was dismantled since it was considered it didn't fit the idea of industrialization. Because the industrialization, this five-year plans, the collectivization, were huge restructuring projects. That's why scholars talk about Stalin's second revolution. Meyer arrives during this time. So Putin was dismantled. And the idea was that now all the creative education should serve the goals of industrialization. It's not about understanding the general laws of creation and philosophically understand the form and then feel the material so that you create objects that can then be produced later. It's not about this. There's a new institution called the Architectural Institute. From the very beginning, there are four departments. When you read the description of this VASI, this Architectural Institute, think, it's not what we read about Hannes Meyer's Bauhaus. It resembles a lot. Architects need to build. That's very important. They need to build from the very beginning. Theory is good, but they need to build. Also, they have to be socially aware. There should be a lot of courses on political science and social sciences. They need to understand how society works. Also, they need to understand to be good engineers. They need to understand how everything works. All sides of engineering construction, they need to have it. So architects are not actually artists. And then the Institute published the newspaper, which is called Proletarian Engineer Architect. That's exactly what it should be. And of course, Hannes Meyer wants to be a part of it. It sounds like a dream. So these youths that she met at the Bauhaus, they have key posts in this new structure. They are yesterday's students, but all of a sudden, since the Cultural Revolution, so the old professors, they were expelled, and there is this youth who now organize everything. So, for example, some important architects and artists are persecuted, and they no longer have any influence. So Hannes Meyer knows this new administration, he met them. And he is entrusted at first with a postgraduate group, these former students who are now important, Arkady Mardvinov, Pavel Nikolai Baburov. These young members of the Vopra group have now a lot of power. But also they've been to the Bauhaus and they understand the value. At first, at least, they understand that Hannes Meyer is actually someone extremely professional and have a lot to learn from him. So we can use his knowledge for our needs. So they organize a group. It's once or twice a week. They have classes and Hannes Meyer teaches them the basic of his understanding of how architecture is done, how to analyze its functions, how to organize circulation, and so on. So he has his teaching that in the end, he manages to have more students, not only postgraduate, but also second year, third year students. And he continues this teaching activity until 1933. Once he arrives, he understands it works very well on paper, but in reality, it doesn't work. And there are multiple problems. And when you actually compare education at this Vasi Architectural Institute and Hannes Meyer's Bauhaus, you understand that Hannes Meyer's Bauhaus was Bauhaus. Because the Vasi, the goal is completely contrary. The idea is not to have a kind of a universally thinking professional which is capable of doing actually everything in architecture, also build furniture or can paint. Or no, the idea is that to have someone who can go tomorrow work in the huge design institute to do some standard operations. So kind of an architectural design conveyor. Because the economy needs is to produce as quick as possible a great amount of new construction. So it's not about architecture with a big A. There are discussions of methodology of this education. And one of the students describes how they are given the task of doing a project for a textile factory in Central Asia. And his task is just to distribute columns inside the huge machine hole. So you are an architect. Your only task is just to put all the necessary columns where they have to be. And some other one just specialized in canteens. So he needs to do all the canteens. And in Meyer's view, architecture doesn't work this way. It's very narrow. And other foreigners who were in Moscow at the same time, foreign architects like German Bruno Taut, he also complained about that. It will lead you nowhere. But this was like a revolutionary experience and Hannes Meyer was a part of it. So there was this work at Gipraftus. There was this juries. There were these consultations for Gipragor as urban planner, even though he didn't have that much experience, but already he's a consultant. And then there is this teaching at the Vasi. So this is a lot. And as soon as he arrives, he wants to organize an exhibition about his Bauhaus. And it's also very important. He arrives not just as all other German or Austrian or, I don't know, Swiss architects, not an average person among others. He is the director of the Bauhaus, and it's not just empty words. And then it's very interesting to look at this exhibition he managed to organize in the end, because it's showing not what his period at the Bauhaus actually was, but what he thinks, what sides of it he should show to get a good promotion in the Soviet Union, to get more influence. And there were very few architects or artists who recalled it, even though they remember there was a German architecture exhibition in 1932. There were some other exhibitions. Such events were very important, and people remember them. what is obvious is that the exhibition was not showing the image of the Bauhaus that people wanted. It was not about steel and glass. It was not about some like fancy objects that were unavailable in the Soviet Union. It was not about some interesting forms, and it was not about industrial progress in architecture. It was something different. There was a lot about the whole scandal about Hannes Meyer's departure, but also a lot about the activity of communist students, which was not related directly to the Bauhaus itself. For example, the newspapers they designed for communist organization was not a part of the Bauhaus schedule, but that's what he showed a lot because he thought, okay, this will work. And also, of course, his architectural projects and textile, because Lena Bergner arrived and she brought the textile pieces. And it's important because it's also something, the idea was to have a sort of a promotional show to get interesting positions for the Bauhäusler. And it didn't really work.
Maybe you remember what Dara Kiese said in the first part of this episode about the Bauhaus Wanderausstellung that Hannes Meyer organized in 1929-30 in Germany and Switzerland. And if you haven't, you should not miss listening to it. It's quite interesting to look into that too and compare it for a second. Meyer's attempt in Germany had been to find new companies, industries and buyers for the Volkswohnung Bauhaus products. Functional furniture made of simple, cheap materials, all of them collapsible to fit into a small package and to simplify arranging interiors and moving apartments. Gropius's goal, on the other hand, was to manifest the Bauhaus in the design world and make it memorable like an art object in an exhibition. That's why we all still today know the Tudor steel chairs by Marcel Breuer, the typical universal lettering in lowercase designed by Herbert Bayer, and the iconic photos of the Bauhaus and the Bauhaus products by Lucia Moholy, but none of the simple wooden furniture of the Volksmöbel, the furniture for the people that Bauhaus students and masters designed at the Bauhaus under Meyer's directorship. In the Soviet Union, again, he tirelessly worked for the cause.
Hannes Meyer invested a lot of energy to try to appeal and to fit into this current of cultural revolution. But unfortunately, it was already not evident, even if you were an ambitious, career-seeking young architecture student, you understand more or less the trend and you want to be a part of it. But it's not obvious. You have to understand well how it all works, what is important to understand, what is not to say, and how best cite Lenin and when to cite Stalin and so on. And as a foreigner, it's really hard. It was always impossible. And Hannes Meyer tries hard, invests a lot of energy, doesn't really work. The exhibition didn't work out the way he wanted to, because even after all this filtering and arrangement, it's still he's the person, Arkady Malvinov, who went to Hannes Meyer's classes and who was part of the Volcker group, who accepted Meyer as a member. He writes an article where you see that he understands really well, but he criticizes it all as something very bourgeois. Another critic also concludes an article very well. He says, to be a part of the Soviet society, they just need to stop being functionalists. They just need to stop being themselves. And Meyer did a lot in this direction. He did really a lot to stop being himself. And it's really painful.
You can find more details about this Bauhaus exhibition in Moscow that Hannes Meyer organized in 1930 on bauhausimaginista.org. There you will find an article by Tatiana herself called After the Ball, and you will see even photos of it and see the simplicity and the huge difference between this exhibition and the Bauhaus Wanderausstellung in Germany and Switzerland, and the even bigger difference to all of the exhibitions that Walter Gropius did on his era of the Bauhaus. And there was also a catalogue for this Bauhaus exhibition in Moscow, and you can find the translated texts of this exhibition catalogue and Modvinov's critique that Tatiana was talking about. I will, of course, link those two articles for you in the show notes too.
As I said, things changed really fast in this time because it's really a huge chaos, actually, on all levels. It's very exciting, very tiring, I guess, very intense, and it's very hard to follow. So, for example, you think you understand how VASI works. Okay, so they want to have a very functionalist education, very narrow. Architects are part of economy. All of a sudden, like only 2 years later, already something changes. And what today was considered important, all of a sudden, it changes. And now all those young cultural revolutionaries who were the first ones to say that we just don't need any architecture as art, we need only industry, and so on. They say, oh, actually, we need to find a way to enrich the proletarian soul. And we need, as communist Soviet citizens, give a possibility to any proletarian to enjoy the beauty of antique architecture. And you have to somehow to come to terms with it and to accept it. There was a very important tool, the dialectic materialism. And a way to explain everything, because there are always reasons. It makes no sense, but as a good communist, you can always find reasons. And this is the exercise that Meyer does. As I said, he also wanted to be someone very active, and he's seduced and he's enthusiastic, which he wants also to show in Europe that he does really well and he's important in Soviet Union. He travels, he does these foreign trips the first summer, also because he has his family, his children, his first wife who is in Switzerland. So he needs to go and see them for holidays. He does those trips and he combines them with public lectures of how things are in the Soviet Union, of propaganda lectures. Of course, in Europe, in Germany in particular, and in Switzerland was not fun either. And it's a crazy political context in general. But they were still people who went to his different lectures, like Georg Schmidt, who's an art historian and the brother of Hans Schmidt, who went to the Soviet Union. And he attended several lectures by Hannes Meyer, like in 1931, and then in 1932 and 34. First, he saw him as a director of Bauhaus in 29 on the Wanderausstellung. And the next time he comes, he said, no, what I said the last time, just forget it. But every time she was very convincing.
Hannes Meyer took on the communist mentality to explain everything away. Not only his ideas about building and architecture had changed, but also his way of communicating. He now had become part of the Soviet propaganda machine, always wishing to finally belong. But the sometimes naive explanations also made him and other Bauhauslers lose sight of reality.
And when I say he had to find arguments in his head for everything, there were articles who report how she was extremely smart in this manipulation operation. Because the critics of the Soviet Union say there are not enough shoes. But if you think of where this comes from, you have to understand the economic situation. Because yesterday's peasants, they now went to the cities, they became workers, and they want shoes like other workers. But Soviet industry cannot produce as many. And it's never the fault of the Soviet system. And this is the way a lot of people believed. And for example, that's how even the craziest, really disastrous things could be facts, could be neglected or ignored, or just say it's anti-communist propaganda, like Lotte Beser. This was Hannes Meyer's architecture department student in the Bauhaus.
Let me just shortly say a few words about Lotte Beser, because she's such an interesting person that would deserve her very own episode too. She was the first woman allowed into the newly installed building department of the Bauhaus in 1927. Under the leadership of Hannes Meyer and later of Hans Wittwer, Beser was involved with planning the ADGB trade union school, about which we have talked in the first part of this episode in detail. The juicy part is that she had an affair with Meyer while he was still married to his first wife, Natalie Herkat. When the affair became public, Lotte Beser left the Bauhaus voluntarily without receiving her diploma. She then worked in Berlin for Hugo Hering and then in Brno with Bohuslav Fuchs, both renowned modern architects. Presumably, Meyer helped organize these jobs for her. Lotte Beser also went to the Soviet Union, where she helped the Dutch architect Mats Damm to plan the new town of Orsk in Siberia. Her son Peter, that she had with Meyer, was born only a little later, and Meyer was then already living with Lena Bergner in Moscow. She would become his second wife. Lotte Beser, on the other hand, married Mats Damm and went to Amsterdam to run an architecture office with him. During World War II, she caught up with her diploma thesis. After the war, she became a central architect in the urban development of Rotterdam. In 1947, for example, she realized the first car-free street in the Netherlands, something the country is famous for today. I promise, one day I will produce a whole episode about Lotte Beser because there's so much more to tell you. But for now, that's it. Let's go back to Tatjana.
she went to work in Kharkiv in Ukraine in the beginning of the 30s. She was basically in the epicenter of Holodomor. She's surrounded by Ukrainian villages because there was a barbed wire around them and people inside them were dying of hunger. So it's really nightmarish. It's with the same arguments that she defended it all. She said, oh, they are bourgeois kulaks. They are rich peasants. They didn't want to separate themselves from their goods or whatever arguments. And Hannes Meyer, the same, for example, the concentration camps, the gulag camps. She saw them because then later she worked as an urban planner. She traveled around the country. I mean, the gulag camps were everywhere. It's not just somewhere in Siberia. But, and then secondly, any construction, there was a lot of forced labor on any construction site. And she somehow was okay with that because she found arguments that explained it all. When Hannes Meyer arrived in 1930, October 1930, there was a very important show trial. The same show trial that later happened in 1936. It's called the Industrial Party Show Trial. There were dozens of engineers and high-standing administrators in different industries who were accused of terrible crimes that made no sense, like trying to empoison Stalin or complete nonsense. It was all staged during the Moscow trials. They were forced to publicly confess the crimes they never committed, and it was all filmed. And Hannes Meyer attended this. He notes that he attended this show trial. In 2018, Sergei Laznitsa, Ukrainian filmmaker, he created a documentary film out of this footage from this trial, which is called The Trial. And I went to see this film in cinema, in the movies. I saw Hannes Meyer. I wrote to Laznitsa, and he was kind enough to send me the video, and I looked at it again, and this is Hannes Meyer, and you can see the image in my book. But this is the only document that we have, like a film we have with Hannes Meyer. And if you think of the context, he's there among the audience in absolutely monstrous show. And that's the first months of his time in the Soviet Union. That's why I think it somehow this did fit in his outlook. Then nothing else could really change it afterwards. Like there were, of course, like minor critiques, but this kind of intellectual operation to justify everything was there, and you cannot deny it. Things that were happening with Nazi Germany, they were so awful that you had to believe that in the Soviet Union things were better, just to have some hope. And of course, very important, as I say, on the one hand, there is this overwhelming lies and propaganda. But on the other, there are elements in this life which impress Hannes Meyer so much, and there's so much energy that somehow counterbalances it. So has the opportunity that he never had. And all of a sudden, he starts doing this urban planning. So after having worked at Yipravtuz, he was invited to work at the Standard Gorproject. It's another huge agency of design of standard cities. Unfortunately, there's a grain of salt to add to this also, because it's not that he was just invited there. Hannes Meyer did a lot to fit into this cultural revolution context. This Standard Gorproject was an institution which was founded under the direction of Ernst May. And Hannes Meyer's role, well, of course, he did interesting urban planning. He traveled to Urals, because the department he had that was charged with design of military and secret cities. So it was not very public that he did. But he traveled around the country and he met these crowds of workers who really believed. Of course, they were the forced labor next to them, but they were also these people who gave very much inspiration. And Meyer was invited there to counterbalance Ernst May and to be like a good foreigner. Ernst May was attacked as someone who doesn't understand the socialist realities, as someone who earns too much money, he takes too much space, he's too important, we need to fight his influence. And that was Hannes Meyer's role. So the paradox is that Hannes Meyer, there is no like building you can see designed by Hannes Meyer in the Soviet Union. Most of his work as an architect was the urban planning designs, and I traveled to a lot of places where he worked, where he proposed some urban designs, but you can only like speculate mostly if for some time this proposal ever worked or not. It's very hard to see. also, it was never in the structure of this urban planning in the Soviet Union. It's always a brigade. It's kind of anonymous. And you have also the general guidelines you follow. So it's very hard to judge which kind of freedom he had in that. But still, he managed to have very original ideas. For example, there is this urban planning scheme for Nizhny Kurinsk. It should have been an industrial socialist city in the Ural region near Perm. And you don't see it when you just see the photo, because what we normally see are several photos of urban planning designs published in the books. But I could find in the archive discussions of this plan for Nizhny Kurinsk. And in the discussion, you see interesting ideas that Kammerer had. For example, in Nizhny Kurinsk, they had a guideline that they were obliged to have 80% of wooden construction and 20% of stone construction. They also were operating with a prefabricated wooden houses, which are mostly like barracks. It's not very rich in terms of architectural expression also. And instead of just having like the city center in stone and the rest in wood, Maya proposes to do some mixed neighborhoods, with the idea that eventually the wood will be replaced with stone, and how it will help to not to create some barrack cities around the monumental city center, but do it like more diverse. It's interesting. And also he got completely obsessed with demonstrations and kind of huge columns and how the city turns into a stage for this mass performances. He was completely blown away with that. You can talk about Hannes Meyer's work when he worked for a plan for Moscow to other architects. They did it privately with Per Böking and Israel Raymondson. And there, it's really astonishing to observe how Meyer wanted to city center look like, because he wants to destroy half of the Red Square. And on the Red Square, you put two skyscrapers, one for the Communist Party headquarters and another for the International Communist Organization, Comintern, also headquarters. And between them, you will have a bridge. And from that bridge, you can observe, it's a fantastic point, a huge demonstrations on the Red Square. Because we only see that if you look closely on the proposal and you read the description of the project in Russian. But there's never like a visualization of like a render of sorts of the city center. You cannot imagine that. Also, there's half of an island in front of the Kremlin, which has to be torn down so that there will be a more beautiful view of Kremlin from the river. The idea of spectacular, it enters his designs in the Soviet Union. I think it's important. And also in Nizhny Kurinsk, which I mentioned, like some kind of not very prestigious industrial city, he was criticized on the discussion of the project because they said, okay, there is a problem with scale. What you propose is just immense. It's just huge. There, he also tried to give this space of experience. It's not what we expect from Hannes Meyer.
All in all, although Meyer's plans that he developed in the Soviet Union were never realized, they shaped his architectural beliefs. After part one and two of this episode, we can now understand his way from a more traditional architect with the Freidorf estate in Switzerland to a futuristic architect of the Neue Bauen in his competition entries for the Peters School and the Palace for the League Nations with Hans Witwer, then on to an architect concentrating in the needs of the people who would use the building and in examining external conditions to create the best possible floor plan, on to an urban planner of whole cities in the Soviet Union who uses all these tools and adds on the socialist component. It already foreshadows what we can expect from his work in Mexico. But that's for the last part of this episode. So let's now see when and why Hannes Meyer left the Soviet Union, why his passionate attempt to become part of the Soviet society all of a sudden became dangerous for him.
The whole story of his departure is quite mysterious. We don't have the exact date of when he left. It's beginning of 1936. What I argue in my book is that, as you understood, he tried to be the best fitting element in the Soviet structure, but it was not possible. At the same time, it was still Hannes Meyer, so he did have very original ideas, but did not always please. So he ended up having a formally prestigious work as a head of an academy, like a department in the Academy of Architecture. But at the same time, he was reduced to a purely bureaucratic position, which was not enough. So he did this very interesting architecture research, and he got involved in some very dangerous affair with a theorist called Achitovich, whom he invited to give a talk in the House of Architects. He was one of the first and very important victims of this end of the 30s terror in Soviet architecture. Hannes Meyer was involved in this case, which was dangerous.
Let's step on the brakes here. I have so many questions now. What was the House of Architects? Who was Achitovich? And what was his lecture about that cost him his life? I'm bringing back Thomas Flehl here, who will explain all of this before we are getting back to Tatjana.
Das er 32 im April wurden ja die Künstlerverbände, also auch die verschiedenen konkurrierenden Architekten.
In April 1932, the artists' associations, including the various competing architects' associations, were dissolved and unified Soviet architects' associations were brought together. And Hannes Meyer supported this process and also had many friends at the Communist Academy, where the supporters of proletarian architecture were. He also played an important role here and there during the formation phase of this Soviet Architects Association. And one of the most difficult events, which in my interpretation ultimately led to his reorientation, was a dramatic incident in 1935 when he was a member of the management of the House of Architects. The Soviet Architects Association was formed provisionally. All these committees were set up by the party, but there was never a Congress. A Congress only happened in 1937. So there were no registered members and the like, but it was always in the process of being constituted. They were, of course, appointed and dominated by the party, and they already had a House of Architects. Hannes Meyer was also part of the leadership, which expressed a certain recognition and reputation.
Eine gewisse Anerkennung und Reputation ausdrückt. Und Hannes Meyer hatte dann einen Kollegen eingeladen zu einem Vortrag.
And Hannes Meyer was the one who then invited a colleague to give a lecture, the sociologist and architect Mikhail Achitovich, who was a constructivist and had previously belonged to the OSSA group, the Association of Modern Architects that was also associated with Ginzburg and the Wesenin brothers. And this Achitovich had also taken part in the competition for Magnitogorsk and participated in the Green City with a more moderate urban, decentralized development. And interestingly, this Achitovich gave a lecture on the national question in Soviet architecture on behalf of or under the invitation and moderation of Hannes Meyer in this House of Architects. And he attempted to reflect historically on Stalin's thesis that architecture and culture in general should be socialist in content and national in form, using an enormous apparatus of categories and then finally arriving at the formula, well, in developed socialism towards communism, architecture would have to be communist in content and regional in form. And with this thesis, which certainly corresponded to Hannes Meyer's approach of taking into account regional characteristics, climatic, ethnic, lifestyles, and specific regions, he caused a storm of indignation. Everyone was obviously very impressed at the lecture itself in January of 1935, because the Stalin and Lenin quotes just rippled out and he managed the category clutter brilliantly. He also dealt with fascist architecture and the international nationless architecture, and what constructivism and functionalism and what proletarian architecture should now be. So he tried to bring in all the current terms into the context, which was courageous and really was only entitled to the party dogmatists. And at the same time, he tried to envisage a kind of transitory development of socialism, which would then show the cancellation in communism and in regional diversity. And that, of course, was ultimately precisely Stalin's cause, that the non-Russian territories, those opposite Central Asia, that these territories should experience a national development through Soviet culture in the first place. So it was basically contrary to Stalin's development to say that it was only now under socialist auspices that national development had to be understood, which led to the absurdity of Leningrad or Moscow architects developing the national culture of Kazakhstan, Azerbaijan, and Armenia, and so on. And it was precisely this contradiction that he addressed. He also referred back to an earlier debate that Ginzburg had already had when he once said, The future of socialist architecture in Central Asia cannot be the mosque, but can only be the home of the ordinary Muslim. So it wasn't about the dignity formulas of the rulers and religious culture, but about the elementary needs of the people, whose way of life naturally reflects the particularities of their way of life, their tradition, and the climate. And of course, if you orientate yourself towards the poor, the deprived population, you also arrive at solutions that lead to the future. This was, of course, a rejection of the idea of giving poorly developed or pre-capitalist societies a catch-up national culture along the lines of a somehow folkloristically adapted modernity or a 19th century national culture. And of course, this took up a topic that was extremely difficult.
Ein Thema aufgegriffen, was extrem schwierig war. Diese Architektur wurde ein paar Monate später.
A few months later, after what was being said had been properly realized, this Architektur was slandered by an enormous press campaign by the Soviet Congress of Architects that was being set up. He was arrested in 1935, released somewhat later, and then, when the great mass reprisals in 1937 took place, he was arrested and shot without a court order. And Hannes Meyer was eliminated from the board of the House of Architects on the occasion of this event, and the party group of the Architects Association expressed the opinion that he was a bit politically naive.
Die Meinung vertreten, naja, der ist ein bisschen politisch naiv.
And there was the sum of reasons, like his frustration. Then this case, which was really dangerous, and everyone could feel that. Also, as I said, as a good communist, always you had to find an excuse. The official explanation was that in 1935, there was a new politics of Stalinist government. There was a popular front in France. The idea was that we no longer consider all other socialist parties and Europe in general as enemies. We need to collaborate with a larger cultural front of all socialist communist parties joined against Nazism and fascism. So in this turn, they were departures of different foreign experts to co-communists to France, to Spain. There was also civil war in Spain. So the inner logic within the communist movement that made it possibly ideologically. And Meyer became close with a group of Swiss communists who came to the Congress in summer 35 to Moscow. This is the very Congress where all this politics was proclaimed. And he joined the Swiss Communist Party because he tried to join the Communist Party of Soviet Union, of Russia, and it was never realized. He did an application, but was not accepted because it took time and nuances. But he did become a member of Swiss Communist Party. And I think he lives here and there. And I think that it's through this connection with the Swiss Communist Party that he managed to justify the idea that he's more useful now on the European front. A front of cultural battle for the Soviet Union. And the idea was that he will leave for Spain. And when all the formalities were done, it was no longer possible because the war already started.
Da gibt's auch, aber nur aus seinem eigenen Zeugnis. Ich habe keine anderen Dokumente gefunden.
There's also, but only from his own testimonies, I haven't found any other documents, the idea of developing an urban planning institute in the Spanish Republic. And in the end, he didn't go to Spain because the coup took place when he was already on the road in 1936. During this time, he was obviously involved in supporting Spanish war volunteers, participants in the international brigades in Spain as a courier service via Switzerland. Following the recommendations of the Seventh World Congress, he was involved in the reorganization of the Communist Party, which was to be oriented towards a united party and overcome the contradictions between social democrats and communists. And relatively little is also known about his time in Switzerland, where Mümmliswil, the orphanage, was built.
Diese Zeit in der Schweiz, wo dann Mümmliswil entsteht, das Kinderheim, ist relativ wenig bekannt.
The orphanage in Mümmliswil in Switzerland is not a radically modernist avant-gardist design, but a conscious combination of a functional understanding of the processes in such an orphanage that Meyer knew from his very own childhood, with a superb alignment in the landscape and with the use of materials from that very landscape, like broken stone, wood, and so on. Mümmliswil shows Hannes Meyer's development from a purist abstract architect to an architect who understood that regional necessities and regional building culture were also important parts. And this is where I leave it at for part two of this episode of Bauhaus Faces about Hannes Meyer. In the third and last part of this episode, you will hear Raquel Franklin talk about Hannes Meyer's work in Mexico and Thomas Flehr and me discuss if Meyer could have been enriching for the architecture of the GDR, where he so desperately wanted to go after World War II. But why wasn't he allowed? Well, tune in next time for answers to all of this. And for today, I would like to thank Tatjana Efrusi for sharing her deep knowledge about Meyer's work in the Soviet Union and to help understand in what kind of circumstances he lived and worked between 1930 and 1936. Last but not least, if you like Bauhaus Faces, please take a second to give it a 5-star review on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, or a thumbs up on YouTube, and recommend my podcast to fellow Bauhaus researchers and fans. And now, there's nothing left to say but tune in next time to a new episode of Bauhaus Faces.